Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of June. In just a moment, the author of a very, very well-written and funny and important book, Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free, Charles Pierce, will be joining us. I just wanted to briefly tell you, though, so we can fill this trip and we'll have a really good time, that we're taking a trip to Springfield. I've been thinking about doing this for a long time. We're doing a Wisconsin Public Radio tour of Springfield, October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. We're leaving Friday morning. We'll be home Sunday night. And what a trip we got going here. First of all, if you haven't been to Springfield, first of all, you have to love Abraham Lincoln or you probably won't like this trip. Or you are really anxious to learn more about Abraham Lincoln, who, of course, is worth learning about because he's endlessly fascinating in my book. So that would be the reason for you to go on the trip, that you want to learn more, you love him, and you're excited about this trip. We have a great lineup here. We're going to be going to, well, to the only place he ever called home. It's his only home in Springfield. Of course, the Lincoln Museum, relatively new, will be, and it's his birthday. It's his 200th birthday. Boyhood home. Well, it's not. It's a place where he learned to be a lawyer. He started off on his own in New Salem, and we'll be going to his final resting place, the tomb of Abraham Lincoln, and oh, so many things going on. Not only that, we have a Lincoln scholar on the bus with us, so it can be, if you want it to be, all Lincoln all the time. This is a guest who's on the Lincoln Bicentennial Commission and has taught courses at UW Parkside. We're going to have a keynote address from Douglas Wilson, who's an eminent Lincoln scholar. He is the co-director of the Lincoln Studies Center at Knox College and the author of Lincoln's Sword, The President and the Power of Words. That's his most recent book on Lincoln. We're going to eat, of course. It's a pretty reasonable amount of money for all of this. And I can't wait. But I love Lincoln. And I know many of you share my love of Lincoln. So to reserve your spot on our trip, and it's starting to fill up, everybody, call Katie at 414-227-2047. 414-227-2047. So that's what I've got to say about that. All right. This is a really funny book. Biting, perceptive, intelligent, very funny. Charles Pierce is our guest. He is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine, contributing writer for Esquire, frequent contributor to American Prospect and Slate. He's written for a number of other publications as well. And this particular book, I guess, came from a piece that he wrote for Esquire. The idea came as he watched the extended coverage of the death of Terri Schiavo, and he says he wondered how so many people could ally themselves with so much foolishness, despite the fact that it was doing them no perceptible good, politically or otherwise. He then read a clip in the New York Times about the Creation Museum, where there are dinosaurs with saddles. And he decided that he would do a book about this, the theme, the consequences of believing nonsense. Some of his ideas to some of you could be rather controversial. It's all right. It's all right. That's what we're all about. So call with John's looking at me. John Trenter's looking at me. What am I getting into this hour? I don't know, John, but let the phone calls come. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello to everybody in my adopted second home state.
It is?
I went to college at Marquette University.
You did? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. 5 years in America's Dairyland.
Oh, it's a
love it to bits.
Wonderful place, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah, we don't have any creation museums, though.
No, but you have wonderful politicians. Also a strange bunch up there, but that's one of the reasons I liked it so much. Any state that produces the La Follette family and Joe McCarthy.
I know, isn't
and
that
my friend Frank P. Zeidler, the late socialist mayor of
Milwaukee. Oh, what a wonderful guy he was.
He really was. He was a very nice man.
Yeah, he was. He was one of a kind. We were sorry to see him go. I had no idea you went to Marquette.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Lived at 16th and Wells Street.
Yes, sir. Actually, one part of the book you write about Oh, I think it's in Oklahoma, but you write about senators. One, it's not the case quite in Wisconsin, but one senator usually tends to be a little wacky and the other senator maybe a little bit more straightforward. What's the piece in the book? I wasn't going to start here, but you mentioned Wisconsin. Is it the Oklahoma senators?
It's Oklahoma, yeah. It's Jim Imhoff who believes that global warming is one of the biggest hoaxes ever perpetrated in America. To which I say, you know, you obviously haven't studied the history of American hoaxes. I mean, we are Amy Semple McPherson. We are P.T. Barnum. We are, you know, I mean, hasn't anyone ever told this guy about, you know, the hook on the door handle and the spiders in the beehive hair? And the other one is a guy named Tom Coburn, who occasionally does more often have spasms of reasons than Imhoff does. But still, at one point during his campaign, told a radio interviewer that there was this outbreak of rampant lesbianism in this, like, really tiny town called Colgate, Oklahoma. And I don't think there's anything rampant in Colgate except, you know, possibly gossip, you know, among people in high school. So, I commended him because, you know, I commended the people of Oklahoma for not, you know, just, you know, not voting just one, you know, wacky person into the Senate, but two.
Yeah. So what is the difference between people who are public cranks, and you have some great stories about early public cranks in America, and those people who are just idiots?
Well, it's not so much there's a difference as so much we've lost the value in the modern age. We've lost the value of cranks. Cranks are proudly independent. Cranks believe what they believe and proclaim what they believe, and while would like to be materially and culturally successful, don't really care if they are. Because of that, they become more intriguing and more valuable to us as kind of prods to our collective imagination. Now, though, I mean, anybody who might be a crank has a book deal, a radio program, a TV spot, or a suit in federal court, and they're also damned respectable. They're not valuable as cranks anymore.
Right. I remember, you know, years and years ago when I first started in this business, I fell victim to some of this as well. Or I realized that shows on UFOs were going to get huge numbers of phone calls. I was trying to, you know, build my audience. I was young, right into radio. And I always wanted to believe in UFOs. I thought that they would change America for the good. You know, about once every 2 months, we'd have a UFO person, and it filled the lines. And then I found myself open to absolutely anybody who had any kind of strange theory because I was open to UFOs.
Sure, because UFOs prod the imagination, which is what
right.
makes them good things. But there's no reason, but there's nobody suing to get ufology taught in high school science classes. There's no school boards in America, you know, tearing themselves apart because one set of parents wants to teach ufology.
Ufology, I haven't even heard that word before.
Sure.
Yeah, that's great. So you start the book at the Creation Museum where the dinosaur is wearing a saddle and where people will believe that perhaps dinosaurs really did wear saddles.
That was the three-line pitch that I sent to my editor at Esquire magazine that prompted the magazine piece in 2005 that eventually became this book was I saw this story in the New York Times about them building this Creation Museum, and one of the precepts of the creationist ideology is that all the animals were created at the same time. Adam named them all, and literally in the Garden of Eden, and the two of all of them were on Noah's Ark, and so this naturally you know, forces you to accept the fact that dinosaurs and men coexisted, which they believe. And as a way of illustrating that, they put saddle on a dinosaur. And I sent a three-line pitch to my editor at Esquire that said, "Dinosaurs with saddles?" question mark. And it all started from there. And as I point out in the book, now that the museum is completed, and everybody should go there because it's really a terrific take, there is a dinosaur. At the end of the tour, there's a dinosaur with a saddle on it, and it's an English saddle. So pretty plainly, this was a dinosaur used in dressage competitions and not, you know, rounding up cattle. So it wasn't a working dinosaur. It was a show dinosaur. But I'll be damned if all the kids at the museum, if that isn't the most popular thing, to climb up on the dinosaur and get your picture taken.
Oh, I'll bet. And then the dinosaurs got on the ark as well?
Yeah. I don't know if you remember the Monty Python skit about the penguin on top of the television set where the two old ladies are arguing. And one of them says that that's from the can't be from the zoo because it's not stamped property of the zoo. And the other one says, well, they don't stamp their animals property of the zoo. You couldn't stamp a great lion. And the first woman says, well, you stamp them when they're small. this is essentially the argument that's made about the dinosaurs on Noah's Ark, which is basically that they brought on small ones, and that the behemoth described in the Book of Job is an actual dinosaur. Mm-hmm. They also believe that the dinosaurs got off the Ark, commingled with man, and that is the basis for all the dragon legends in all the different cultures around the world, which I find a fascinating theory and would have been much more interested in hearing about it. But having, you know, dropped this little tidbit on you, then they give you the hell in the handbasket section about how we're all doomed to eternal flames because we believe in Charles Darwin, and the whole place gets very boring again.
Where is this place?
It's in Hebron, Kentucky, just outside of Cincinnati.
Okay, and I don't know if you spent time listening to the guy who founded it, or tell us about the guy who founded it. It's amazing how you can make a buck.
Yeah, well, he's a guy named Ken Ham, who was a legitimate paleontologist. The fossils at the Creation Museum they're quite good. I mean, the uses to which they're put are bizarre, but they're very good fossils. He's a legitimate paleontologist from Australia who has become a believer in biblical inerrancy and promotes the creationist movement and is very, very fundamentalist about it. He's more negative on the concept of intelligent design than I am because he considers it secular backsliding. He took his knowledge of paleontology, which, as I said, is perfectly legitimate, and just took it in a very bizarre direction, and you know, is insisting upon it as legitimate science, which devalues him as a crank.
Yeah, it follows the pattern of others in your book of people who have reached conclusions before gathering any data.
Right. This is a substantial amount of cherry picking, basically. But in his case, it's taking the data he has and conforming it to 4,000, 8,000-year-old scripture.
Right. What was particularly upsetting to you, Charles, about the Terry Schiavo case?
Well, I mean, let me count the ways. I mean, everybody we know, I know because I've had a father and four uncles and aunts who had Alzheimer's disease, which was the subject of my first book, actually. Everybody deals with end-of-life issues, and everybody knows how hard they are, and everybody knows how difficult the choices to be made are. A lot of people have dealt with hospice who I think do the best work in American society. I mean, it's long. There is never a good conclusion to it,
right.
And people are willing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought all of this was dragged in to an unthinking media circus by people with their own agendas who didn't really care very much about anybody they were affecting. And that leads off the part of the book called Consequences, which are the consequences of believing nonsense. If we allow the three great precepts of Idiot America to run wild, real people get hurt. Mm-hmm. And real people got hurt in this one. Mm-hmm. Not merely Michael Schiavo, but the people working in the hospice who are pretty much the people I write about, who are trying to do their jobs for a number of different families while this carnival act was going on across the street.
Yeah. And we got a diagnosis taking. I mean, there were so many weird aspects of this. A diagnosis from Frist.
We had Bill Frist on the floor of the Senate, an actual physician diagnosing someone he'd never seen. You had nurses who had been already dismissed by several judges as being completely non-credible, showing up on Fox News and spouting their non-credible opinions without being under oath. You had doctors inventing causes of actions. You had the president of the United States leaving a vacation for the first and only time in his presidency to come back and sign a specific bill. You had his brother, the governor of Florida, flirting with the notion of having his state police confront the local police over this. You had a great woman, one of the real heroes of the book, a woman named Annie Santamaria, who is the director of patient services at the hospital, stuck in her office while two priests almost got in a fist fight in the lobby, and she couldn't break it up because there was a federal marshal there, because the Congress of the United States was going to subpoena Terry Schiavo to come to Washington and testify.
Oh my
and this
gosh.
Is just the levels of nasty preposterousness here are almost bottomless.
Wow. Why does it happen? Why did that happen?
Because people didn't care, because people didn't think, because people perceived a political and social advantage where there probably was none, because people in my business determined at some point that because there are two sides to every question, they both must be right.
Right.
And it's because everything that makes Idiot America, Idiot America ran wild in this particular case.
It sure did. And what about this idea that, we run into it here on public radio of all places, too, that there must be two sides to everything. We find that when you want to do a show on the evolution, you got to do something, you got to balance your show with intelligent design, or you've got to balance global warming, even though 99.999% of all scientists know that it's happening, with some other ideas that it's not happening. They're not equal. I'm sorry, they're just not equal.
No, and that is the problem with treating everything as though it were political argument. We are required, in fairness in our business, to treat both, to treat political ideas as being equally worthy of explication, and most of them probably are. But everything that is an issue in politics is not a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
Terry Schiavo was not a political issue. There were no politics there, except those that were ladled and grafted on top of this until it collapsed on top of everyone. And not everything is. I mean, there are two sides to every question, and some of the sides are just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they're just we should be aware of that, and we should be on our guard against that. People in our business and the people who consume what our business produces.
Right. And the Schiavo case was particularly egregious because it must have been so incredibly painful for people involved in it. And to have this national spectacle about it was particularly horrible.
Well, they had, there were people who were working there who would go home at night and watch CNN or watch Fox or watch MSNBC and see the events of their lives being talked about in a way that was completely detached from reality.
Right. Right.
There was a woman named Elizabeth Kirkman who was a volunteer at the hospice who had been actually gotten cited by both Presidents Bush, by the father and the son, as being a point of light. Remember the points of light that
sure.
George H.W. Bush promoted? And she got a certificate from Governor Jeb Bush about her work at the hospice. And she was threatening to send them back. She was, because she would walk in to do her volunteer work and somebody would call her a Nazi.
Oh my gosh!
I mean, and this was all being ginned up by people with agendas further removed than Terry, that had as much to do with Terry Schiavo as they had to the Sacred College of Cardinals. There was no connection to the actual people and the actual events.
Right. And this has become more problematic now. You write about earlier people, and I want to talk about some of them because they're really interesting. But when you just had a pulpit or you were writing your books and people did reviews in newspapers, it was one thing. You could be a crank, a genuine American crank, and maybe be pretty harmless. It takes on a whole different dimension when we've got television.
Yeah, because basically, I mentioned that, things that what I call the three great premises of Idiot America, and I'll just run them down quickly for
sure.
You. The first one is any theory is valid if it moves units or drives ratings points or sells books. Anything can be true if someone. Second one is anything can be true if someone says it loudly enough. And the third one is fact is that which enough people believe, and truth is determined by how fervently they believe it. And that's all. And those are all, because those are essentially premises based on salesmanship. On selling ideas as though they were products, where it doesn't matter if the ideas are correct. It doesn't even matter if the ideas are beneficial. It just matters if you can sell them. And that's and that's basically the problem with Idiot America, as far as I'm concerned.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The author of Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free, is our guest. He graduated from Marquette University, actually, and calls Wisconsin his adopted second home. He's also a regular on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and Only a Game. He's a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine, contributing writer for Esquire, and writes for all other kinds of notable publications as well. All right. Oh, and then the email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Charles, and let's start with Ray from Milwaukee. Hello, Ray.
Hi. I'm curious about how many people in the United States believe the government's conspiracy theory of 9/11. And I'd like to bring up just a few facts the government has admitted to since all of this has happened. The NSA was tracking the hijackers all the whole time they were in the United States. They were tracking their phone calls back to Bin Laden's headquarters, presumably. And this has all come out now, and the FBI admitted in the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, they said there were no cell phone calls from any of the four planes that morning, yet people believe that people could make phone calls from 5 miles in the air going 600 miles an hour. And if you know anything about cell phones and how they work, you'd know that that is physically impossible, especially at that time. And then right at 275 of the 9/11 report, page 275, there is a FBI agent in Minneapolis who calls his superior 70 times in 3 weeks leading up to 9/11. And his calls state exactly that. He thought this guy Moussaoui and his group of friends wanted to crash planes into the World Trade Center.
All right, let's hold it there. And you write about conspiracies. We'll go beyond 9/11, but what do you think?
Are you asking me?
Yes, Charles.
Oh, I'm sorry. If you think I'm going to go into the weeds on the 9/11 truthers, you're out of your mind.
I know.
It's not in my book. It's not a topic I'm going to be. It's not a topic I'm going to discuss. I think, you know, a lot of folks need to get lives about that day.
Well, you write about conspiracies in your book, though, and the number of people who believe that there was not a lone assassin in the John Kennedy assassination. I think you do write about what people believe. Not what exactly what Ray said, but that a lot of people believe that there was forewarning of 9/11, et cetera. We're willing to believe what is not an official truth about a situation.
I think there's a value. I mean, the problem with conspiracy theories in this country is they're all sold as products now.
Right.
I think, you know, as I say in the book, I remember when Iran-Contra broke, and it was an actual conspiracy. I mean, there really was one there, and it was crazy. I mean, selling missiles to the people who blew up our Marines. You know, sending people with a Bible and a cake in the shape of a key, this was nuts. But after about 6 months, all you heard from people, and I don't mean just the media, I mean people outside, were, well, we're all bored with it, it's too hard to understand. Now, we're a country that is willing, the people who believe that that the United States government was somehow complicit in the assassination of John Kennedy is a big percentage. It's hardly moved at all since 1965, since the release of the Warren Commission. Any country that's willing to spend that much energy to believe in a conspiracy theory shouldn't find Iran-Contra that hard to understand, because it wasn't that hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly not as hard to understand as some of the Kennedy conspiracy theories, but it's easier to believe in conspiracy theories than to confront actual conspiracies, because conspiracy theories, as I said, are sold as products now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to take any action. I mean, if that huge percentage of Americans who believe that the government was complicit in the assassination in broad daylight of a president of the United States actually believed it to the point of taking action, we'd have had buildings burning down in 1964. But we don't, because conspiracy theories are a product we buy to anesthetize ourselves. And I think the 9/11 truthers are right up there we have the same problem, because as long as you believe that, you don't have to confront the fact that your government was incompetent and couldn't keep you safe.
Right.
So no, I'm not going to pursue who knew what when before 9/11, leading to, you know, them blowing up Building 7 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I'm just not going to do it.
It's amazing how you have to spend so much time doing that. And we don't do shows on it either, I must tell you. But you do have a part in the book that looks at how everything gets so convoluted. I believe it was the uncle of one of the people who died in Flight 93, and this memorial for that.
Yeah, they're building a memorial to Flight 93 out in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. You know, it's one of these kind of we build memorials now basically as places for meditation, almost the way we used to build cemeteries. And they had input from the families, obviously, of the victims on Flight 93. And they put it through bids, and they hired an architect. And so this guy Paul Murdoch, a Los Angeles-based architect, won the bid. So he put a plan together, and it's a kind of a curved structure with the names of the passengers and crew, you know, in white marble, and a line of trees, and a structure containing 40 wind chimes, and one for each of the passengers. And you know, it looked like a very peaceable place, and everybody seemed to be happy. And then a blogger named Alec Rawls got a hold of this and determined that not only was this not a proper memorial, but it was designed specifically to honor not the victims of the flight, but the hijackers. And the way he concluded this was that it was the shape of a crescent, which, as we know, is a Muslim design.
Oh my gosh.
This got on the internet. It roiled up the community there. It drew the attention of a bunch of bloggers. The guy changed the design.
Oh my gosh!
All because some blogger got a lunatic conspiracy in his head and was able to sell it well enough that there was some noise about it.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Adam from Nina. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Go ahead.
First of all, I'd like to say I don't blame you for wanting to stay hands off on the 9/11 issue. That's an intense one. Second of all, I'm currently a college student, and the difference in the way that you're engaged in your education between college and high school, middle school, things of that nature, is just night and day. I mean, when you're writing a paper in college, you have to back up your sources. And I guess my question is, in what way do you think the education system is kind of responsible for this dumbing down of America, for this ability to just believe things and not have to back that up? And I'll just take the response on the air. Thank you.
Okay.
I'm a little bit shy about the dumbing down of America thing because I this really is not a dumbing down of America book. It was deliberately conceived not to be. I think we get so much information so quickly from so many different directions now that the circuits that used to enable us to process it and to discern which is valuable and which isn't are burning out. And I think that's the problem we have. We have a whopping amount of information, yet we don't have time to winnow it at all. So we just accept it wholesale. So, and I think that if there's one thing the colleges can do a better job at is teaching the critical thinking skills that will enable us to do that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about some of the people in the book, because I wasn't aware of the history of Ignatius Donnelly. And people have talked about Atlantis for a long period of time. It's found its way into popular culture in recent years. I didn't know that it was his baby. He's quite a character, isn't he?
He's a fascinating, fascinating guy. And would that he had stopped in Wisconsin and not Minnesota. But he was a Philadelphia lawyer and a politician, and he decided that there were too many lawyers in Philadelphia and far too many politicians, and so he decided he was going to get out to the West and make some money and land. So around 1855, when he got married, this was in the middle, of course, of the great immigration boom that affected not only Minnesota but Wisconsin as the people fleeing the revolutions in Europe in 1848 started coming to the United States, and he got in with a guy named John Nininger. And they were going to build a town on the banks of the Mississippi. It was going to be called Nininger, and Ignatius Donnelly was the salesman. So he and his wife moved to St. Paul, and they put out handbills and sold the land. And it was 500 people moved there. There was a library, there was a music hall, and he talked about how this was the march of civilization. And then the panic of 1857 hit. Nininger went out. And the railroad failed, and there was not going to be a ferry across the Mississippi. And he just sat there in his own big house in this collapsing city and decided. And while he was doing that, he was reading a great deal. And then he decided to go back into politics. And he became a congressman from Minnesota, went through the Civil War. And then in 1868, he ran afoul of some local political leaders in Minnesota. In the middle of a huge, messy campaign, he got beat. His political career at that point was over. He goes back to the house in Nininger, and he decides he's going to become a writer. And the first thing he writes is a book called Atlantis, The Antediluvian World. And this is a result of it's a remarkable performance of pseudoscientific cherry-picking. I mean, it's everything he read, and he read vast amounts of stuff. He used to play hooky from his congressional office and go to the Library of Congress and spends hours there. And everything we think we know about Atlantis, all those speculative documentaries on the History Channel, have their roots in his work. He literally invented the modern conception of Atlantis. And he wrote a book, and it was a wild success. I mean, there were 23 editions of it. The revised edition was published as late as 1949.
Goodness.
Which is almost 50 years after he died. He corresponded with William Gladstone. He corresponded with Charles Darwin. And he became, as the New York Star called him, the most unique figure in our national history. And then he went on to a subsequent bunch of books. One was called Ragnarok, which posited that early prehistory has its start with a collision with a comet and that threw up a cloud of dust and caused, among other things, Atlantis to sink. And then he went after Shakespeare. He became a Baconian and proved, you know, conclusively through his vast amounts of cherry-picked research that Francis Bacon had written Shakespeare's plays and ultimately Donnelly claimed he'd written Philip Marlowe's plays and Cervantes' novels. Say what you would about the guy, he didn't name Small. But he, to me, was the classic American crank because he didn't really care if his books sold. He was happy they did, and he was happy to be famous. But all he cared about was this unique, bizarre field of interest he carved out himself. And there's a line in his diaries, among other things, he kept vast diaries. There's a line in his diaries that sums up to me what the American crank and the value of the American crank is all about. He said, "I believe I'm right, or if not right, plausible."
Oh, I love that. That's great. And people, and so that was the foundation because people have been writing about Atlantis, large numbers of books since then. And heavens knows if you get one more, Shakespeare really wasn't a Shakespeare book.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the point of it? Who needs it?
No, I mean, and everything up to and including, as I point out in the book, Donovan's hit Atlantis.
Right.
From the 1960s.
Right, I forgot about that.
Yeah, which is all about, you know, Atlantis sending out people to the corners of the world and its civilization flourishing elsewhere after the city sank. That's all Ignatius Donnelly.
Right.
I mean, at one point he attributes the biblical story of the Tower of Babel to the Atlanteans' attempt to keep their heads above water.
Right. Let's go next to Dave from Cincinnati. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I understand you folks are talking about stupidity, how it became a virtue in America, and I believe a museum that I'm associated with, the Creation Museum, has kind of been held up as an example of that. Is that true?
Yeah, actually it is.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm one of the idiots here. And
I make it quite plain that you're not.
That I think would be comparable to yours in science. Have a PhD in cell biology from Brown, was 34 years in the faculty of one of America's premier medical schools.
Which one?
A Washington University School of Medicine.
Okay.
In the Department of Anatomy and Neurobiology, I was the histology editor for 5 editions of Stedman's Medical Dictionary,
mm-hmm.
a guest lecturer for a semester at Stanford University Medical School.
Uh-huh.
And
your background leads you to believe
science.
That humans and dinosaurs coexisted and that Adam named the dinosaurs?
Well, certainly from the point of view of Scripture, I believe there was an Adam and there was an Eve. And
Adam sat there naked and named the saber-toothed tiger.
Well, we need to look at what can we learn scientifically.
No, we need to answer that question first.
Because that's what's proposed in the museum. Ape-like creature has turned into man. I reject that.
No, we need to answer my question.
Wait, can we just do one person at a time or we can't make sense of what's going on.
We need to answer my question. Did Adam sit under a tree as depicted in the Creation Museum and name the saber-toothed tiger?
Well, I don't know whether he named the saber-toothed tiger.
Your museum
does. In the Bible, he named all creatures.
I don't know how many of them he named.
But he did give a name, and those names wouldn't necessarily be names we have today. As you know, names of cities and places and people change through time.
Being
I think the important thing
Wait a second, do we really have to
dismiss people who disagree with us
I'm
as
not
idiots?
Dismissing you. I'm
Can't
asking
we say
you to
we have
question.
Different understanding?
I'm asking you to answer the question. Did Adam, a human being, a single human being, sit under a tree in the literal Garden of Eden and name the animals?
He named some animals, yes. Whether he named all of them, or whether he named particularly the saber-toothed tiger, how would I know? And whether that name today is the same name he gave it, I have no way of knowing that.
Your museum claims to.
The point is that...
No, the point is your museum claims to.
Scientists who have a substantial background in science, of which we have several people here, disagree with the evolutionary paradigm. We have another view. It is indeed based on... biblical presuppositions, and our view is certainly shared by a significant majority of Americans today.
A significant majority of Americans believe that the government was involved somehow in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Should that be taught in America's public history classes, public school history classes?
Do you think they should be taught in school, Dave?
what I would like to see in the public school, I certainly don't want, Bible taught in the public schools. I have serious concern of what would be done there. I'm not looking for prayer in the public school, that sort of thing. But if the public schools feel obliged to teach something about origins, how everything came to be, I think they should do so in a critical way. Are we still here? I'm hearing beeps.
Yeah, we're still here.
They teach that a literal man named Adam sat under a tree and named the animals, every single animal that ever lived on Earth.
Creation Museum, we have qualified scientists who have
distinguished backgrounds
in science, and we're critical of the evolutionary world.
Is there a scientific basis by which you can conclude through experiment and the possibility of scientific falsification, is there a scientific method you can prove that Adam sat under the tree and named all the animals?
No, of course not. I don't have a scientific method for that. Do you have a scientific method that can prove that life has evolved from a methane ammonia atmosphere?
Then don't tell me it's science.
All right. It's
that simple.
I don't think we're getting anywhere with this, but it was interesting to listen to, certainly. So thank you, Dave, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655.
You can't have your credentials and eat them, too.
What about Dave's point that you need to teach evolution with a critical eye?
I think you do, and I think you have to teach it in science class. If you want to propose that we teach a course in comparative religions in public schools in the United States of America, I'm all for you. I think it's great because the influence of religion is important on world culture, and anybody would deny it. But I wish you luck, by the way. If you do put in a course in comparative religion in the public schools, I wish you luck the week that you're doing the unit on the Quran right now. But in terms of teaching comparative religions and the origin myths of various religions, I think, sure, teach it there, but don't teach it in science class.
Thanks, Dave, for your call. Matt from Madison is next. Hi, Matt.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm interested in maybe a class of people slightly different than the last person who called in. The last person seemed to be somebody who is helping to spread certain ideas, and we might think, or at least your guest on the show, his problem with the caller might be that, you know, he was intellectually confused about the concept of evidence and what can count as evidence. But I'm more interested in just the everyday people who are consuming the ideas that are spread, like by the people like the last caller. And I'm wondering if the problem with the people consuming the ideas is not so often an intellectual problem. It's not that they're not well educated enough or not smart enough. A lot of the time, they're perfectly well educated and smart enough. But do you think the problem is character flaws with these people?
Oh no, I don't think these are bad people. I also agree with you. I don't think these are stupid people. And as I point out in the book, idiot America is not the people who go to the Creation Museum and believe it. Idiot America is the rest of us who are too lazy and all of a sudden find these ideas floating into the mainstream without our standing athwart them yelling stop. But I don't think it's a character flaw. I think that would be very harsh. I think there are good evolutionists and bad evolutionists. There are good creationists and bad creationists. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's a character flaw. I do think there are people who are locked into dogma because for a number of reasons they don't like change very much. I mean, there are a number of different reasons, I think.
Well, what would you call these people? And it's a huge number. You point in your book to the Gallup poll 2007 on evolution. Is it intellectual laziness that leads so many people to believe in intelligent design?
Well, I think, a lot of it, I mean, some of it may be intellectual laziness. Some of it may be my firm belief that people lie to pollsters, because I know people lie to pollsters because I do usually. And I think that, if a pollster comes to you and says, do you believe in intelligent design? The pollsters pollsters don't measure reflection or nuance. They measure, sometimes closely scientifically, sometimes not. They measure instant answers. And, people will reflexively say sure, But if you press them, and you have to if you're going to teach it in schools, then you realize that that all intelligent design is gussied up creationism.
Mm-hmm. Is this guy from the Creation Museum calling into other talk shows?
I have no idea.
It was the first time, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return and welcome phone calls, more of them for Charles Pierce. Charles is the author of Idiot America, How Stupidity Became Virtue in the Land of the Free. Our lines, we have one open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You spent some time early in the book, well, quite a bit of time, actually, with James Madison, described by somebody as the Charlie Brown of the Founding Fathers. Tell me what is the connection between the country being founded on untested radical ideas and the emergence of public cranks and perhaps the later emergence of, you know, a mass media that's spreading untruths in order to get, you know, money, power, et cetera.
I always have. He's not the studly tall redhead that Thomas Jefferson. He's not the marble icon of George Washington. But the guy is the only person who's ever overthrown the American government. He did it by being smarter than someone else, than everyone else. So yeah, I do like him. I do like him a great deal. And I think that, you know, he established a framework that required people to be informed. That's the thing. This country doesn't run on automatic pilot. We're supposed to be involved, informed citizens. We're supposed to take active roles. We are supposed to govern. We're not supposed to be governed, as an old friend of mine named George Reedy used to say. That having been said, he also set up the framework whereby everything was free. Freedom itself was free. And he set up a framework that where you would not only produce a country, a self-governing democratic republic, but you'd produce a culture that produced Mark Twain and Faulkner and Jackson Pollock and Little Richard, and ultimately the greatest country ever devised, to be completely out of your mind. And that, I believe, is the kind of underground effect, the shadow effect, the doppelganger effect of Madison's work on the culture of the country that became the United States of America.
Interesting. Let's go to Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks. Last night, for the first time ever, I watched a TV program called Lie to Me, which is premised on the idea that a set of private investigators are through a sort of combination of neuro-linguistic understanding and non-verbal cues figure out whether
this is a fictional show, right? This isn't a reality show.
No. Oh, no, not at all.
It's a drama, right?
I mean, even listen to the term reality. This is as applied to reality shows, This is a show that's entertainment, but it like all entertainment, it teaches certain things, and it presents in a sort of quasi-scientific manner this notion that these people can discern things that the rest of us cannot. And I'm wondering, if you feel that, you mentioned Iran-Contra and that sort of thing, that when you have a good salesperson, and in that case, I think the good salesperson was Ronald Reagan, or a good salesperson is Dick Cheney, who says recently on an interview program that Colin Powell is unlikely to be a Republican, but Rush Limbaugh is. And I just think there's a corruption of the standards of public knowledge that's going on.
I think I agree, and there's a long section in the book, oddly enough, about reality television, which I don't think is quite as big a threat as the fact that you had people in the White House meeting to decide how to torture people and taking their cues from 24. I mean, I think if these people had been watching American Idol, we all might have been better off. But I think that, you know, I would disagree that Ronald Reagan in the context of Iran-Contra was that he got rescued there because he was a great salesman. I would say he got rescued there because he was a great product. People had already bought the idea of Ronald Reagan as this kind of detached, amiable guy who certainly couldn't have been, you know, presiding over an administration that sold missiles to the people who killed our Marines in order to finance, you know, death squads in Central America. So I would disagree to that to an extent. But again, I mean, you look at the career of Ronald Reagan. You look at the extended funeral that he had over the week when he died, and you know there are entire portions of his life that were airbrushed, including his entire first marriage, because he was sold as a product and not as and is sold as a kind of a novelized human being. and not as a real person. And I think that became a problem, especially in the context of what happened as the second term ran out. I mean, I say in my first book, which is about my family's experience with Alzheimer's disease, I have no doubt in my mind that Ronald Reagan was a symptomatic Alzheimer's patient for most of his second term.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There's no question. If you look at the first debate with Walter Mondale in Louisville, I swear, that was the one where people said that he had a bad job because he was overbriefed. If one of the questioners had asked him, Mr. President, what city are you in, I guarantee you he wouldn't have been able to give him an answer that night.
Interesting.
And I think there's a lot of evidence, as Jane Mayer and Doyle McManus's book, Landslide, where a lawyer from the White House counsel is tasked at one point to look up the constitutionality, the constitutional ramifications of presidential succession, because they weren't sure either. And I think a lot of people in that White House didn't want George H.W. Bush to succeed to the presidency because they didn't like him very much. But I don't think there's any question that we were governed for the better part of 1984, 1988 by a symptomatic Alzheimer's patient.
Thanks, Rich, very much for the call. You also make reference to John Kennedy, and who, you know, if we could describe him now, the complexity with which we would describe him is quite different than how he was sold to us then.
Yeah, and the great thing about it is he himself would have been tremendously amused by, you know, the whole Camelot thing, and, you know, this is a guy who used to run around Vegas with Frank Sinatra, and he really was, you know, sitting at home listening to, you know, Treacly Lerner and Low Music. I don't think so. He was the first novelized for television president. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot going on with him that we probably should have known as self-governing citizens that we didn't know.
He was sick?
He was very sick. He really was. And his government was barely under control, and there was stuff going on behind the scenes that was astonishingly bad. And then, of course, you know, good old Daniel Patrick Moynihan, one of the smartest people who ever lived, pointed out that the basic problem with the Warren Commission was that it did not investigate Kennedy's death with the presupposition that nobody was going to believe it, which it should have. Hmm. And we might have all been saved a lot of, you know, long movies.
Yeah. So what about now? Are we in a new age of enlightenment?
Yeah, everybody asks this. I think we're doing a little bit better. I think we still have a long way to go. I still think, with the forces that, the three great premises of idiot America are still valid, and they're still holding firm. You know, truth is still, fact is still what enough people believe, and truth is still determined by how fervently they believe it. I mean, I think you can see indications of that all the way around. But I do think we're blinking a little bit from the rubble of the last 7 years. The interesting thing, of course, is that for about 7 or 8 years, perhaps longer than that, we were ruled by a political political elite that had taken the premises of idiot America and ridden them to political success. And when it crashed hard and loud. And it crashed in Terry Schiavo, and it crashed in New Orleans, and it crashed on global warming, and it crashed, God knows, in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And real people pay the price. And that's the real. If there's a serious lesson to all the, what I hope is, a fairly funny book, it's that. Mm-hmm. That there are consequences to believing nonsense, and occasionally they are very severe.
Yeah. We have time for maybe one or two quick calls.
Sure.
Dave from Lafarge, hello.
Good morning.
Lafarge? Where's Lafarge?
Wisconsin.
I know that, but where? I live there, so I used to live there, so I just never heard it.
Oh, about 6 miles east on Highway 82.
Oh, okay. Oh, go ahead. I was just curious. I never heard it before.
My question is, I wanted to ask you if you've ever debated this Ken Ham fella publicly.
No.
Okay, and in that debate, I use three rules of debate that seem to be quite missing in our conversations these days, which are very simple. There's only three. One is, I might be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Second one is, that's very interesting. And the third one being, I never looked at it that way before. Seems to me that if we, I thought of this during your conversation with the other gentleman earlier, is that if we all use those rules of debate, as I call them, that would funnel us into a more productive outcome in our conversation. So would you use something like that? If you
I think there's certainly a difference between debate and argument. Debate, and I think we've lost the distinction. I think debate to me always implies that you're moving toward some other place. An argument is just sort of sterile and just stays in one place. But I don't know. I don't see a debate with someone who believes what the Creation Museum right. believes is going anywhere, because I don't accept their fundamental premise. I don't accept the literal interpretation of Scripture, and I never will. And they're not going to convince me to do it. I mean, I just can't do it.
So you might be right would be something that
would yeah, be I mean, hard you might say, you know, you might be right that there are holes, you know, that evolution, you know, evolution is a theory constantly undergoing revision. Yes, because of that, we should accept the Bible's account of creation. No, mm-hmm. I can't say you might be right on that.
Well, we should also make mention of the fact that the book is very funny, Charles.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's laugh out loud.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, this
has
been great. Say hi to Wisconsin for me.
All right, you did.
Take care.
Yeah, thanks. Charles Pierce. Charles' book is Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. It has just been published by Doubleday. He went to school, as you heard him say at the beginning of this show, at Marquette University. He's also a regular on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine, contributing writer for Esquire, and has contributed frequently to American Prospect and Slate, the New York Times Magazine, LA Times Magazine, The Nation, The Atlantic, and the Chicago Tribune, among many other publications. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks, of course, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow. I'm not sure what we're talking about tomorrow, but we'll figure it out. From 9 until 11, and there are many great hours ahead here, too, so stay with us. It's a minute now before 11 o'clock on this Tuesday morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.